A little content warning. The text featured in today's episode is all about the pains of life and includes some statements along the lines of, perhaps it would be better to be dead than to continue to live. I expect you will know if that is something you might prefer to skip. This is Medieval Death Trip for Saturday, October 19th, 2024, episode 109, concerning the miseries of the flesh according to Pope Innocent III. Hello and welcome to Medieval Death Trip, the show where we explore the wit and weirdness of medieval texts. I'm your host, Patrick Lane. In last episode's selection from the Melrose Chronicle, we largely wrapped up the conflict between King John of England and Pope Innocent III. Our Patreon supporters also got to hear an appendix to that episode, some canons of the Fourth Lateran Council convened by Innocent. It is generally believed that rather than being the product of the debates of the council attendees, Innocent himself was the author of the 73 canons, which were simply presented for adoption to the gathered prelates. Today, we'll hear a bit more from Innocent, though under his birth name, Lotario de Canti di Segna, because the work we'll be hearing from was written in 1196, about 2 years before he became pope and took on the papal name of Innocent III. This work is De Miseria Humanae Conditionis, or The Miseries of the Human Condition, a tract intended, as he tells us, to puncture the pride of human beings. When he was writing the De Miseria, the future pope was only Cardinal Lotario de Segna. Lotario was one of the somewhat rare cardinals who was not a bishop, but rather a university-educated clerk, a career functionary in the Roman Curia, rising to the office of subdeacon before being elevated to cardinal deacon in 1190 by Pope Clement III, his uncle. At the time the College of Cardinals selected him to be pope, he had not yet taken holy orders. He was neither priest nor bishop, so those deficiencies had to quickly be remedied before he could take on the pontifical office. And at that time, he was just 37 years old, which is unusually young for a pope. Only a handful of men under 40 have been elected pope in the history of the church. Just 2 years earlier, Cardinal Lotario was writing the De Miseria in a period of idleness. He uses the Latin word ocio to describe it, which could be read as leisure or unemployment, and scholars have interpreted it in different ways. Some have inferred that he was on the outs with Celestine III, the new pope who followed his uncle Clement and who was a member of a rival aristocratic Italian family, so that Lotario's idleness was really a kind of light exile from the Roman Curia due to political tensions with Celestine. However, more recent scholarship has challenged this assumption and shown that Lotario was still involved in doing work for Celestine, so whatever circumstances led to this period of free time for writing were probably not as dire as the political exile scenario. But it's easy to see why the image of Lotario in exile felt right to so many, because that's a turn in one's life that might inspire you to write a tract on the miseries of the human condition. But we shouldn't assume this work is an expression of personal suffering by Lotario. The De Miseria is part of an established and popular genre, or theme, or spiritual trope that goes by the name Contemptus Mundi, contempt for the world. This is a kind of ascetic worldview, or one thread of a worldview, that sees the temporal world and the flesh as corrupt, fallen, and a constant temptation away from spiritual devotion and upright living. More specifically, the kinds of worldly things frequently condemned in Contemptus Mundi rhetoric are wealth, because you can't take it with you, personal vanity, because your body is gross and destined to decay, and you should be pouring all that energy into the care of your soul instead. Taking delight in food and luxuries is condemned for similar reasons, as is sex, though that gets tied up in a whole additional set of associations with sinfulness and corruption. Another common thread links to pride and vainglory as stirred up by too much engagement in temporal pursuits like business and politics, which does highlight a key point about the world one is showing contempt for. It's not about contempt for the natural world, despite how much it dwells on images of how gross the human body can be, especially in extremity. But fundamentally, and according to Orthodox doctrine, God's creation is good, and it would be sacrilegious to condemn it. To condemn flesh for being flesh is heretical. It's something you see in sects like the Cathars or the Manichees in the time of Augustine of Hippo. Rather, Contemptus Mundi is more about how humans choose to exist embodied in the created world. The mundus in Contemptus Mundi is less the physical world versus the spiritual world, as it is the world of human activity versus spiritual matters. It would really be better named contempt for worldliness rather than contempt for the world, but that ship has sailed. The roots of Contemptus Mundi go right back into antiquity and biblical times. Its sentiments are in Ecclesiastes, aka Qohelet, as well as in the prophets. The ascetic practices of the Egyptian hermits, the Desert Fathers, lay more groundwork, along with Greco-Roman Stoicism. But it's in the 12th century that it all coalesces into a rhetorical convention distinctive enough to be named. Of course, it is more than just rhetoric. We seem to lack a good term for what something like Contemptus Mundi is. Ideology is too big. It's more like one thread you might weave into an ideology. Wikipedia calls it, quote, a theme in the intellectual life of both classical antiquity and of Christianity, end quote. Which is okay, I guess. Theme feels a bit vague. Trope feels too small. Genre is a bit too specific, though texts have been labeled as Contemptus Mundi texts, as though it is a genre. Maybe there's a really obvious term available that Wikipedia and I have both overlooked. If you have any suggestions, I'd love to see them on social media. Anyway, Contemptus Mundi is strongly tied to the High Middle Ages, both in its literary forms and in actual ascetic practice, especially among some of the leading figures in the development of Christian mysticism. And it doesn't stop with the Middle Ages. It persists into the early modern period and gradually falls back into intellectual obscurity as the Enlightenment deprecates many medieval ideas. The earlier texts establishing the 12th century Contemptus Mundi theme tended to be monastic, written by monks for monks, where withdrawal from worldly affairs is already a central tenet of life. Writing at the very end of that century, Lotario's work is a bit different. It is not monkish or cloistered. It is a work by a very active agent of the Holy See, someone deeply involved in a world of both scholarly and legal debate, as well as politics and diplomacy. When he is writing scathing portraits of human vanity, he is writing both about and for the other busy members of the papal court that he is in the middle of. And unlike his monastic literary forebears, Lotario doesn't advise turning away from the world, becoming a hermit or a monk. What he offers instead is something more like an academic exercise in listing out all the ways that life as a human being sucks. He does this over the course of three books, closer to chapters by modern standards, and today we're just going to hear from book one, The Miserable Entrance Upon the Human Condition, which focuses on the body and the basics of living and surviving. Book two describes different kinds of sinful behavior, and book three concerns death and damnation. We may well come back to those in the future, especially all the little character portraits that show up in book two. That's where you most feel the personal history of Lotario and his courtly experiences coming through. Today's selections are a bit more universal, though even here, there are windows into Lotario's biography. For example, as you listen to his description of the effects of old age on the body and mind, consider that 35-year-old Lotario is writing this while serving Pope Celestine III, who was nearly 90 years old at the time. And that's 90 years old with 12th century medicine, not a modern, sprightly 90. This is very much one of those texts that lives up to the name of this podcast, in that it confronts us with a medieval perspective on the world that feels especially alien to our own post-Renaissance humanist attitudes in a way that makes it seem especially grotesque. I assume. I mean, we are entering the post-humanist era, and there is a certain cyberpunk resonance in Lotario's disgust for the meat and viscera that we're all made of. And let me pause here just to note that it's kind of wild to listen to this text's discussion of the vileness of human conception and know that this Catholicism has continuity with the Catholicism producing so much of the babies are beautiful anti-abortion rhetoric today. There are, of course, nuanced ways that a modern theologian can demonstrate how these are not incompatible positions, but it remains a bit jarring, I expect, to hear a future pope writing, quote, "Happy are they who die before they are born, experiencing death before knowing life," end quote, and who quotes the prophet Jeremiah, quote, "Would that I had been slain in the womb, so that my mother might have been my grave and her womb an eternal conception," end quote. So, while I expect Lotario's representation of the body is fairly off-putting to a modern reader, post-human attitudes notwithstanding, he might win some of you back with his assessment of the miseries brought about by imbalances in wealth and power, where the circumstances of feudalism seem startlingly relevant to modern concerns. Lotario also touches on practically modern existentialist angst in asking, what's the point of all this stuff we do in our lives if everything is just going to rot in the end? And even if you do strive for body positivity in your worldview, some of Lotario's descriptions of the frailties of our flesh, of disease and old age, may yet ring true. So, while on the surface this text probably feels very remote, you may find things in it you connect with more than you expect. Though, maybe this isn't surprising. After all, if you have a text whose basic premise is that everything is terrible, then whenever it covers any area where you today also think things are terrible, you will find some resonance with the text. The unrelenting negativity of this text may indeed make it feel a bit more modern, but a reader with historical perspective might well find it odd. This is a churchman writing. It's all well and good to talk about how corrupt the world is, but you're supposed to do that in order to sell the miracle of Christian salvation, right? Where is the salvation here? And the answer is, it's not here. In his preface to the De Miseria, Lotario states that with encouragement, he might write the companion text to this tract, one on the dignity of the human condition. Presumably, that is where the balance to the equation would come in. But as far as scholars can tell, he never got around to writing the sequel. And if perhaps he did, it clearly wasn't popular and didn't survive. What did survive and was popular despite, or perhaps because of, its hyperbolically one-sided pessimism was the De Miseria. It has been preserved in around 700 manuscript copies and translated into nearly every European language. Chaucer claimed to have made a translation entitled The Wretched Engendering of Mankind, though sadly no known copies of Chaucer's version have survived. Lotario's tract continued to be popular into the early modern period, with more than 50 different printed editions before the 1700s. In Protestant countries, it continued to be translated and printed, though often with its authorship unattributed, since the association with a Catholic pope would have tainted it. As I stated earlier, the further into the Enlightenment you get, the more Contemptus Mundi and the De Miseria fall into obscurity, and by the 1800s, Lotario's bestseller is known to pretty much only scholars of medieval history and literature. Why, for such a long time, though, was this downer of a work so popular? It might tap into some of the elements of negativity bias I talked about a couple of episodes ago, but it might be simpler to say it's an example of the Dante conundrum. The Inferno is exponentially more popular than the Paradiso because hell is just more imaginatively engaging than heaven. What sounds more fun? Reading a book about how good and dignified people can be and how nice everything is, or one that raises its fist to the sky and calls out everything that's rotten in humanity? What sells better? Books about saintly lives or true crime? Paradoxically, I suspect the human propensity for relishing accounts of horrible things is one of our traits that Lotario would have also condemned as a form of vanity if he could have taken one little step further outside of his own rhetorical lens. Anyway, let's get into the De Miseria. Much of the text, especially in Book 1, is drawn from or modeled on earlier writers. It is a tissue of quotations, mostly from the Bible, but also some classical poets and the occasional patristic citation. To help indicate this, I will mark quotations with a little audio cue, which I think will really give you a sense of how this thing is put together. There are a couple of modern English translations. I have one by Margaret Mary Dietz and edited by Donald R. Howard. Here's what Howard says about this translation. Quote, "In revising Miss Dietz's translation, which aimed at literal accuracy, I have sometimes resorted to paraphrase. I have tried to retain any notable characteristics of the original style, which are not, to us, downright outlandish, but as best I could, I have turned medieval, quote, eloquence, when it seems absurd in present-day English, into some modern equivalent," end quote. Part of the mission of this podcast is to revel in the original rhetoric of medieval writers, albeit in translation, so Howard's attempt to clean up the text rubs me the wrong way. Though I should say that some side-by-side comparisons show that he hasn't radically altered things. But that, combined with the fact that Dietz and Howard's translation is still under copyright with no clear living rights holders to contact for permissions for use, I have had to do the thing that I mentioned in episode 105 might be happening, which is to use machine-assisted translation of the original Latin. That said, I'd like to think that this is assisted in a real sense of that word. This is not raw ChatGPT output. I used a combination of ChatGPT and Google Translate, and I went through it sentence by sentence with the Latin and my handbooks and dictionaries, and did a fair bit of revision myself, always trying to get closer to the sense of the original. I don't use machine translation without qualms, and if there had been a practical path to using Dietz and Howard's translation legally, that's probably what I would have preferred to use, even with Howard's tinkering with Lotario's sometimes overwrought style. But I really wanted to bring this text to you this month, and this was the means to do so. So, with that addressed, let's get into it. Here are selected chapters from Book 1 of De Miseria Conditionis Humanae by Lotario de Segna, the future Pope Innocent III. Preface. To the most beloved father, the Lord Peter, Bishop of Porto and Santa Rufina, Lotario, an unworthy cardinal deacon, wishes grace in the present and glory in the future. A small amount of unoccupied time, which I recently seized amidst many troubles for the reason you know of, did not entirely pass by idly for me, but I used it to describe, in some manner, the lowliness of the human condition, in order to suppress pride, which is the head of all vices. I have dedicated the title of this little work to your name, asking and requesting that, if your discernment finds anything worthy in it, you attribute it entirely to divine grace. If, however, your lordship advise it, I will, with Christ's favor, describe the dignity of human nature, so that just as the proud may be humbled by this current work, the humble may be exalted by the other. 1. On the Miseries of Humanity. Why did I come forth from my mother's womb only to see labor and sorrow, and so that my days might be consumed in confusion? If such words were spoken by him who was sanctified by God in the womb, what should I say about myself, whom my mother conceived in sin? Woe is me! I might say, O mother, why did you give birth to me, a son of bitterness and sorrow? Why did I not die in the womb? Why, when I came forth from the womb, did I not perish immediately? Why was I received on the knees, fed at the breasts, only to be born into destruction and as food for the fire? Would that I had been slain in the womb, so that my mother might have been my grave and her womb an eternal conception. For I would have been as if I had not been, taken from the womb directly to the tomb. Who will give my eyes a fountain of tears so that I may weep for the miserable entrance into human existence, the guilty progress of human conduct, and the damnable exit of human dissolution? Therefore, let me consider with tears from what man was made, what man does, and what man will become. Truly, man was formed from the earth, conceived in guilt, and born to punishment. He commits wicked deeds that are not lawful, shameful acts that are unfitting, and vain actions that are not useful. He becomes food for the flames, prey for worms, a mass of decay. Let me explain this more clearly. Let me unfold it more fully. Man was formed from dust, from mud, from ashes, and what is more vile, from the most impure seed. He was conceived in the itch of the flesh, in the heat of lust, in the stench of luxury, and what is worse, in the stain of sin. He was born to toil, fear, and pain, and what is more wretched, to death. He commits wicked deeds by which he offends God, offends his neighbor, and offends himself. He commits vain and shameful deeds by which he pollutes his reputation, pollutes his person, and pollutes his conscience. He commits vain deeds by which he neglects the serious, neglects the useful, and neglects the necessary. He will become food for the fire which always burns and is inextinguishable, prey for the worm which always gnaws and consumes and is immortal, a mass of decay which always stinks and is horribly filthy. 2. On the vileness of our matter. So the Lord God formed man from the mud of the earth, which is the most ignoble of the elements. He made the planets and stars from fire, gusts and winds from air, fish and birds from water, but men and beasts from earth. Therefore, if man contemplates aquatic creatures, he will find himself lowly. If he contemplates those of the air, he will acknowledge himself to be even lower. And if he contemplates those of fire, he will consider himself the lowest of all. Nor will he be able to compare himself to heavenly beings, nor dare to place himself above earthly creatures, for he will find himself equal to beasts and will recognize himself as similar to them. For the fate of men and beasts is one, and the condition of both is equal, and man has no advantage over the beast. Both are born from the earth, and to the earth they shall return together. These are not the words of just any man, but of the wisest Solomon. What then is man except clay and ashes? For thus does man say to God, "Remember, I beg you, that as clay you have formed me, and into dust you have returned me." And thus does God say to man, "You are ash, and to ash you shall return." "I am compared," he says, "to clay, and am likened to ashes and cinders." Clay is made from water and dust, both of which remain. Ashes, however, are made from fire and wood, both of which are consumed. This is a profound mystery, but it will be expressed elsewhere. Why then, O clay, are you proud? From what, O dust, do you exalt yourself? On what, O ashes, do you glory? 3. On the manner of conception. Perhaps you will respond that Adam himself was formed from the mud of the earth, but you were begotten from human seed. Indeed, he was formed from earth, but from pure earth. You, however, were begotten from seed, but impure seed. For who can make clean that which is conceived from unclean seed? What is man that he should be pure, or one born of woman that he should appear just? Behold, I was conceived in iniquities, and in sins did my mother conceive me. Not in one iniquity alone, nor in one sin alone, but in many iniquities and in many sins, in my own sins and iniquities, in the sins and iniquities of others. For there are two conceptions, one of seed and the other of nature. The first occurs through acts committed, the second through conditions inherited. Parents commit the first, offspring inherit the second. For who does not know that intercourse, even within marriage, is never entirely free from the itch of the flesh, the heat of lust, and the stench of rankness? From this the seed conceived is fouled, stained, and corrupted, from which the soul, when it is eventually infused, contracts the stain of sin, the blemish of guilt, and the filth of iniquity, just as liquid poured into a corrupted vessel is itself corrupted, and, touching what is polluted, becomes polluted by that contact. The soul, indeed, has three natural powers, or three natural capacities. The rational, to discern between good and evil, the irascible, to reject evil, and the concupiscible, to desire good. These three powers are originally corrupted by three opposing vices: the rational power by ignorance, so that it does not discern between good and evil; the irascible power by wrath, so that it rejects good; the concupiscible power by concupiscence, so that it desires evil. The first, ignorance, generates fault. The last, lust, gives birth to sin. And the middle one, wrath, generates both fault and sin. For fault is failing to do what should be done, and sin is doing what should not be done. These three vices are contracted from corrupt flesh through three carnal temptations. In carnal intercourse, the insight of reason is dulled so that ignorance is sown, the itch of lust is excited so that wrath is propagated, and the craving for pleasure is satisfied so that libidinousness is produced. This is the tyranny of the flesh, the law of the members, the tinder of sin, the weakness of nature, the food of death, without which no one is born, and without which no one dies. Even if guilt passes one by, sin always remains in the act. For if we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. Oh, heavy necessity and unhappy condition! Before we sin, we are bound by sin, and before we transgress, we are held by transgression. Through one man sin entered this world, and through sin death passed into all men. Have not the fathers eaten sour grapes, and the teeth of the children are set on edge? 4. On the food by which the fetus is nourished in the womb. But consider by what food the fetus is nourished in the womb. Surely by menstrual blood, which ceases from the woman after conception, so that the conceived may be nourished by it within her. It is said to be so detestable and unclean that, from its contact, crops do not sprout, vines wither, plants die, and trees lose their fruit. If dogs eat it, they are enraged into madness. The conceived fetus contracts the vice of the seed, such that lepers and those with elephantiasis are born from this corruption. Hence, according to the Mosaic law, a woman who suffers from menstruation is considered unclean, and if anyone approaches a menstruating woman, he is commanded to be put to death. And because of the uncleanness of menstruation, it is commanded that if a woman bears a male child, she should abstain from entering the temple for 40 days, but if she bears a female, for 70 days. 5. On the weakness of the infant. Why then is light given to the wretched, and life to those who are in bitterness of soul? Happy are they who die before they are born, experiencing death before knowing life. For some are born so deformed and monstrous that they seem not to be human, but rather appear as abominations. It would perhaps have been better for them never to have come into sight, since they are displayed as monsters, shown as spectacles. Many are born with diminished limbs and corrupted senses, causing sorrow to their friends, disgrace to their parents, and shame to their relatives. But why should I speak in particular about some, when, in general, all children are born without knowledge, without speech, without strength? They are pitiful, weak, and feeble, differing little from beasts, or rather, in many respects, having less than they do. For animals, as soon as they are born, walk. We, however, not only do not walk upright on our feet, but we cannot even crawl on our hands while bent over. 8. What fruit does a person produce? Oh, the worthless indignity of the human condition, unworthy condition of human vileness! Investigate the herbs and the trees. They produce from themselves flowers, leaves, and fruits, while you produce from yourself lice, fleas, and gutworms. They pour forth from themselves oil, wine, and balsam. You, from yourself, produce spit, urine, and excrement. They exude a sweet fragrance, and you emit an abominable stench. As the tree is, so is its fruit, for a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. What is a human body but a kind of upturned tree? Its roots are the hair, its lower trunk is the head with the neck, its upper trunk is the chest with the belly, its branches are the arms with the legs, its leaves are the fingers with the joints. This is the leaf that is carried away by the wind, and the stalk that is dried out by the sun. 9. On the inconveniences of old age. At the beginning of human existence, men are said to have lived for 900 years and more. But gradually, as human life declined, the Lord said to Noah, "My spirit shall not remain in man forever, for he is flesh, and his days shall be 120 years. This can be understood both as the limit of human life and as the period for repentance. From that point on, men are rarely recorded as living longer, but as human life receded more and more, the psalmist said, "The days of our years are 70 years, and if strong, 80 years, but most of these are labor and sorrow. But now my few days are coming to an end. Our days pass more swiftly than the fabric is cut by a weaver. Man born of woman, living for a short time," and so on. Few now reach 40, and even fewer reach 60 years. But if anyone advances into old age, immediately his heart is troubled and his head shakes. His spirit weakens and his breath becomes foul. His face wrinkles and his stature bends. His eyes grow dim and his joints tremble. His nose runs and his hair falls out. His touch trembles and his activity ceases. His teeth decay and his ears grow deaf. The old man is easily provoked and difficult to calm, quick to believe and slow to disbelieve, grasping and greedy, sad and complaining, quick to speak and slow to listen, but not slow to anger. He praises the old times and scorns the modern ones, criticizes the present and commends the past, sighs and worries, grows bent and falls ill. Listen to the poet. Many inconveniences surround the old man, and so on. However, neither should the old pride themselves over the young, nor should the young grow arrogant against the old, for what we are now, he once was, and what he is now, we shall someday be. 12. On the various pursuits of human beings. Mortals run and wander through hedges and pathways. They ascend mountains, cross hills, fly over cliffs, traverse the Alps, pass through ditches and enter caves. They search the bowels of the earth, the depths of the sea, the uncertainties of rivers, the darkness of the forest, the inaccessible paths of the wilderness. They expose themselves to winds, rains, thunder and lightning, waves and storms, disasters and extremities. They mine and smelt metals, carve and polish stones, cut down and shape wood, spin thread and weave cloth, cut and sew garments, build houses, plant gardens, cultivate fields, tend vineyards, light ovens, build mills, fish, hunt and trap birds. They meditate and think, plan and organize, argue and litigate, plunder and steal, deceive and deal, fight and wage war, and perform countless such tasks to gather wealth, multiply gain, pursue profits, acquire honors, exalt dignities, and expand powers. And this, too, is labor and mental anguish. If I am not believed, let Solomon be believed. "I made great works," he said. "I built myself houses and planted vineyards. I made gardens and orchards and planted them with all kinds of trees. I made for myself pools of water to irrigate the forest of growing trees. I acquired male and female servants, and I had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. I gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and the delights of the sons of men, cups and vessels for pouring wine, and I surpassed in riches all who were before me in Jerusalem. And when I had turned to all the works that my hands had done, and to the labor with which I had toiled in vain, I saw in everything vanity and vexation of spirit, and nothing endures under the sun." 13. On various anxieties. Oh, how great the anxiety that torments mortals! Care oppresses them, worry disturbs them, fear terrifies them, trembling shakes them, dread overwhelms them, pain afflicts them, sadness disturbs them, turmoil saddens them. The poor and the rich, the servant and the master, the married and the celibate, indeed, the good and the bad, all are afflicted by worldly torments and are tormented by worldly afflictions. Believe the teacher with experience. "If I am wicked," he says, "woe to me, and if I am righteous, I will not lift my head, being filled with affliction and misery. 14. On the misery of the poor and the rich. The poor are oppressed by hunger, tormented by hardship, hunger, thirst, cold, and nakedness. They are scorned and wither away, despised and humiliated. Oh, the miserable condition of the beggar! If he asks, he is ashamed. If he does not ask, he perishes from want, yet he is compelled by necessity to beg. He accuses God of injustice for not dividing things fairly. He blames his neighbor for being unkind and not offering enough help. He becomes angry, grumbles, and curses. Take heed of the wise man's judgment on this matter. It is better to die than to be in need. Even a poor man is hated by his neighbor. All the days of the poor are wretched. The brothers of a poor man hate him, even his friends keep their distance from him. When you are prosperous, you will count many friends, but if the times grow stormy, you will be alone. What shame! A person is valued according to their fortune, when, instead, one's fortune should be judged according to the person. A man is deemed good because he is rich, or bad because he is poor, when, instead, a man should be judged as rich for being good and poor for being wicked. The rich, however, are undone by excess and consumed by arrogance. They pursue pleasure at will and fall into sin, and the instruments of their punishments are the very things that had been the delights of their sins. The effort of acquiring wealth, the fear of keeping it, and the pain of losing it continually wear out their minds, disturb them, and torment them. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. But more on this will follow subsequently. 15. On the misery of servants and masters. The servant is terrified by threats, exhausted by forced labor, afflicted by beatings, and stripped of possessions. If he has nothing, he is forced to acquire something. If he has something, he is compelled to lose it. The master's fault results in the servant's punishment. The servant's fault becomes prey for the master. Whatever madness kings indulge in, it is the common people who suffer. The wild ass in the desert is prey to the lion, so are the poor to the rich. Oh, the extreme condition of servitude! Nature bore them free, but fortune has made them slaves. The servant is forced to endure, but not allowed to show compassion. He is compelled to suffer, and no one is permitted to suffer with him. Thus, he belongs to no one, not even to himself. Wretched are those who serve in the military, for it is miserable to live from another's table. If the master is cruel, he must be feared due to the malice of his subjects. If he is gentle, he risks being despised because of the insolence of his subordinates. Thus, fear torments the harsh master, while contempt weighs down the gentle one. Cruelty breeds hatred, and familiarity breeds disdain. The master is wearied by constant care and harassed by domestic concerns. He must always be prepared and well armed to guard against the snares of the malicious, repel the injuries of attackers, crush enemies, and protect citizens. Nor is the trouble of one day enough. Each day brings new labors, and each night carries new anxieties. Therefore, the days are laborious, and the nights sleepless. 22. On the proximity of death. The last day is always considered the first, yet the first day is never considered the last, even though we should always live as if we must always be ready to die. For it is written, "Remember that death does not delay." Time passes and death approaches. 1,000 years in the eyes of the dying are like yesterday, which is past. The future is always being born, the present is always dying, and whatever is past is entirely dead. Therefore, we are always dying as we live, and we only stop dying when we stop living. It is better to die for life than to live for death, for mortal life is nothing but a living death. As Solomon said, "I have praised the dead more than the living, and judged happier still those who have not yet been born. Life quickly flees and cannot be held back, while death approaches relentlessly and cannot be prevented. This is the remarkable truth. The more life grows, the more it diminishes, for the more life advances, the closer it approaches death. 27. On the various types of tortures. What can I say of the wretched ones who are destroyed by innumerable kinds of torments? They are beaten with clubs and slaughtered by swords, burned by flames and crushed by stones, torn apart by claws and hung on gallows, twisted by torture devices and scourged by whips, bound in chains and bruised by ropes, thrown into prisons and wasted by hunger, cast down and drowned, skinned alive and dismembered, cut to pieces and pierced through. Those destined for death, to death. Those destined for the sword, to the sword. Those destined for famine, to famine. And those destined for captivity, to captivity. A cruel judgment, an immense punishment, a sorrowful spectacle. They are given as food to the birds of the sky, the beasts of the earth, and the fish of the sea. Alas, 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 wretched mothers who have borne such unfortunate children. So, there you have just some of the miseries of the human condition as presented by Cardinal Lotario di Segni, better known as Pope Innocent III, widely regarded as one of the most significant popes of the Middle Ages, if not the most significant. Now, how does Lotario gain his innocence? Well, the taking of a regnal or papal name is a custom first seen in the 6th century, when Mercurius, priest of St. Clement's Basilica, was elected pope and, it is said, decided that it was inappropriate for the head of the church to bear the name of a pagan god, Mercury. So he adopted the papal name John II, after Pope John I, who had died while imprisoned by the king of the Ostrogoths just a few years earlier and was being venerated as a martyr. But most other popes in the first few centuries of Christianity kept their birth names into their papacy. It's not until the 10th century that the practice becomes the dominant custom, but you still find occasional popes foregoing it, all the way up until 1555, at the end of the papacy of Marcellus II, who had retained the name he was given at baptism. But all popes after him, so far, have adopted a papal name. That said, nothing more than custom mandates the taking of a papal name today, and there is no formal code or requirements for the selection of a name. The pope is free to choose whatever name they like, though traditionally they honor papal predecessors or role models or important figures to the pope, like saints or mentors or even relatives. Lotario left no explanation for his choice of Innocent as his papal name, but it's believed that he likely was honoring a predecessor from half a century earlier, Innocent II, perhaps because he had reasserted papal supremacy over the Holy Roman Emperor, which was a policy the new Innocent was also keen on. And perhaps Innocent III was emulating his namesake when he called the Fourth Lateran Council, as Innocent II had called the Second Lateran Council, which famously included a canon prohibiting the use of bows and crossbows by Christians against other Christians on pain of excommunication, though any glance at medieval history will show you that this canon was clearly not taken very seriously. Moving on from papal names, I did want to talk a little bit about papal terminology. The word pope itself is pretty straightforward. It comes from Latin papa, itself derived from Greek papas, where it meant father, and thence was used for patriarch, which the Latin church took up in the sense of bishop. And, of course, the pope is the bishop of Rome. The word papa began to be linked specifically with the bishop of Rome and the head of the church in the 5th century, but it wasn't officially reserved for the pope until the 11th century. Papacy and papal both derive from papa. But we have a whole other set of terms associated with the pope: pontiff and pontificate and pontifical and pontifical. These have a more interesting origin. They come from the Latin pontifex, the term for a high priest in ancient Rome. It was also, in the form Pontifex Maximus, taken on as a title by some Roman emperors, who seldom had qualms about intermingling church and state. Some Roman authors give the etymology of Pontifex as a maker or builder, fex, of bridges, pontes. Pontifex, bridge builder, the idea being that a priest is one who bridges the gap between humanity and the gods. Or it might have something to do with yet more ancient customs in which Roman priests oversaw the building and or blessing of bridges or river crossings over the Tiber. Or maybe actually it's not about bridges at all, and the root is not pontes, but puntis, meaning a propitiatory offering. So it's one who makes offerings to the gods. Or the root is maybe potus facere, meaning having the power to do. Or then again, maybe it comes from a lost Etruscan word of pre-Roman origin. In other words, we don't really know where this word comes from, but we can at least say that a bunch of later Roman authors and the medieval authors that followed them went with the bridge builder etymology, whether it's actually true or just something that sounds true and is an attractive metaphor. It's certainly presented as the origins of the word without qualification in many articles and discussions today. Anyway, Pontifex shows up in a Christian context as the word used in the Latin Vulgate for the high priest of Jerusalem. From there, as you head into the early Middle Ages, it serves the same role as Papa. It means bishop. Pontifex Maximus begins to be used in reference to the Pope, and although Pontiff holds on longer than Papa as a general term for bishop, it and its derived forms do come to be primarily associated with the Pope, although the term pontifical mass still means a mass celebrated by a bishop, not exclusively by the Pope. In English, pontiff is a latecomer, not really showing up until the 1500s. Papa, on the other hand, shows up in Old English, eventually losing its perceived inflected ending and becoming pape. The pronunciation shift from pape to pope happens in Middle English, though both forms linger side by side well into the modern period. To wrap up our dive into etymology, our mystery word this episode is a fun one. It is furcifer, F-U-R-C-I-F-E-R, like Lucifer if he was a puppy dog or an anthropomorphic fox, perhaps. But that does point us to the etymology. Who is Lucifer? He is the light bringer or light bearer. Lux Lucas is light plus fero, to carry, to bear. So we know the last element of furcifer. It carries something. What is that something? Well, it's a furca, a fork. So furcifer, which would be closer to the classical Latin pronunciation, is literally a fork bearer. But while that touches the origins of this word, it doesn't really convey the meaning in actual usage. For that, we turn to George Meriton, glossing useful Latin words for an English-speaking audience of, as the subtitle of his book enumerates, young clerks, but also young scholars, apothecaries, surgeons, coroners, clerks of the peace, etc., and several other persons. That book is Nomenclatura Clericalis, or The Young Clerk's Vocabulary in English and Latin, printed in 1685. According to Meriton, furcifer means a rake hell. Well, that's helpful. The Oxford English Dictionary tells us that a rake hell is, quote, an immoral or dissolute person, a scoundrel, end quote. A rake hell is someone who rakes up or combs through hell, a troublemaker, a hell raiser. Though it seems the connotations are more sins of desire and passion and vanity than violence or brutality. So what does being a scoundrel have to do with carrying a fork? Well, not unlike Pontifex, there are several related but not identical possibilities. We know furcifer was used as a term of abuse for slaves in the Roman world. A furca could be a pitchfork, so the reference might just be to common agricultural laborers. But furca was also used to refer to a particular instrument of punishment, not a pitchfork, but a forked piece of wood that would be put around a person's neck and secured like a yoke. On a similar theme, we find furca used to refer to fork-shaped gallows. So furcifer could be equivalent to phrases like gallows rogue or gallows bird or hangdog, which does originate from the idea of describing a low person fit to be hanged like a dog. On the other hand, a furca could also be a fork-shaped pole used for carrying things on the back. I imagine a little bit like a hobo's bindle. So that image evokes both a laborer and also perhaps a vagrant, which would have its own associations with rascality. Today, furcifer is the scientific name of a genus of chameleons, in reference to the forked shape of their feet. I don't know if it says anything about their character. Another modern survivor descends from rakehell, which gets shortened simply to rake, a word still in use, though usually in a self-consciously old-fashioned way. A rake is a cad, a libertine, a man prone to debauchery, especially womanizing. You might also call a rake a Lothario, the same as the birth name of Pope Innocent III, Lotario or Lothario or Lothar or Luther, depending on the language. But the libertine Lothario is not directly connected to the Pope, alas. It comes from the name of a character in Nicholas Rowe's 1703 play, The Fair Penitent. Lothario, a rake who seduces a married woman. Rowe may have found inspiration for the name from a character in Don Quixote, or maybe a similar character from an earlier play, but The Fair Penitent was a huge hit in its day and is the reason Lothario entered the English language as a popular allusion, very much on the same pattern as Don Juan and Casanova. And that brings us to the end of this episode. You can get full references for today's texts and secondary sources at our website, medievaldeathtrip.com, where you can also find links to our various social media accounts, including Instagram, Mastodon, and Blue Sky. You can also email me with questions or comments to patrick@medievaldeathtrip.com. And there are also links on our website to a pair of Spotify playlists of spooky music handpicked by me. Unlike our Christmas playlist, there's no particular effort to make those medieval. They just reflect my own taste in spooky music, but may my vanity be forgiven. I consider myself as having been something of a connoisseur of horror soundtracks since the age of 9 or so, maybe even earlier if you count how often I listened to A Night on Bald Mountain and In the Hall of the Mountain King as a preschooler. So I feel I know my way around a Halloween playlist. So, if you need some spooky music to do chores to or study by, check out the Spotify playlists MDT Spooky for instrumental tracks and MDT Spooky Songbook for things with lyrics. If you like, you can support the show materially through Patreon at patreon.com/MDTpodcast. Our patrons get access to bonus audio content, like the appendix to last episode I mentioned earlier, as well as an audiobook and even some movie commentaries. I'd like to recognize and thank our new and returning Patreon patrons. So thank you, Louise and AK, for your support of the show. It's highly appreciated. Until next time, if you're ever feeling like all is vanity and vexation of spirit and there is no profit under the sun, just remember that to everything there is a season, turn, turn, turn. And thanks for listening here at the Turning of the Seasons.